The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Welcome to DSC's Campfires with Larry Wysoon, the unique blend of hunting, conservation, and the outdoor lifestyle, delivered in an entertaining, informative fashion that only a veteran outdoorsman can do. DSC Campfires is brought to you by DSC, Conservation and Hunter Advocacy, Hornady, Accurate, Deadly, Dependable, Trigicon, Brilliant Aiming Solutions, Taurus, makers of the Raging Hunter and other fine handguns, Mossberg, a leader in firearms since 1919, Hassel Cattle Company, the world's best jerky, and Wagyu Beef. Now, here's your host, Larry Wysoon.
Well, welcome to the Campfire. This morning, I have got a very special guest, Mr. Herman Broun. Herman has kicked around a fair amount over the years. He's been a bronc rider, champion bronc rider, had been a guide, continues to guide occasionally, an entrepreneur. If you hear some shots in the background, we're actually on Herman's home ranch. It's been in the family for a good many years, and there's a, I think somebody's out there maybe shooting a Sharps rifle with a Sharps match, and I noticed earlier there's some smoke coming out, so I'm assuming they were shooting black powder cartridges at this point. So, Herman, welcome back. We had you on some time ago, and I've been wanting to get you back on ever since. Now, before we turned this thing on, we were talking about some of the guiding stuff that you've done, and you mentioned Mexico, and we were talking about some editors and some assignments that you've gotten over the years as a writer, and to say all that, too, we just finished a radio show that you do, an episode, and what's the name of that radio show?
It's News from the Camp House.
News from the Camp House. How do people access that? And then we'll get into some of these other things.
KULM 98.3 FM. It's a local radio program out of Columbus. Now, thankfully, I've been doing this since August of 2000. And it's a weekly program every Saturday morning, 6:30 a.m. Central Time. Most, you know, now you've got internet, you can live stream it. So anybody can watch this, you know, anywhere. But it's 6:30 a.m. on Saturday morning Central Time. And the premise of the program is that there's so many conversations, so many discussions that go on around a hunting camp, fishing camp, any kind of a camp, any kind of a gathering. And so often a discussion will end with a question of how does something work? How does something actually, you know, what, you know, there's always a question at the end a lot of times. And that is the premise, is that I go out and I find answers. I'm going to find somebody that is expert that can answer the question of why things are the way they are and what we're doing about it. And whether it's legislators, whether it's state agencies, federal agencies, attorneys, biologists, whatever it takes, we're going to go find the person that can give a good answer that will satisfy people as being the truth.
With that said, I kind of took us astray there for just a little
That's
bit.
Right.
I'm glad I did, because we just finished an episode this morning. You and I got a chance to visit about a lot of different things. But let's go back to the Mexico thing. What's happened? You guided in Mexico. Of course, you guided up in the Bob Wilderness with Bob Marshall Wilderness area for years and other places up there. And you were mentioning that you really like the wilderness.
Right. That's the thing. You know, hunters are going to have preference of what style of hunting do you like? And that's fine. That is Boy, I mean, that's great. Texas is 95% private property. All right, so you're going to have all different brands of honey in Texas. It's whatever you have access to, whatever type of preference you have, that's great. Go enjoy the outdoors however it suits you. All right, me, personally, I like the wilderness. I like saddling a horse, packing up mules, packing into the mountains, and living, you know, 1800 style up in a wilderness area. That is what I have enjoyed. You know, first time I went to Montana was in 1978. And I, you know, went, me and the neighbor boys all would go to the hills through the 80s and just go have fun. Well, one of them turned out to be an outfitter, and I started guiding with him, and guided with him in the Bob Marshall Wilderness up until 94. Then another outfitter picked it up, and I guided with them through 99. There was one year that I ducked off, and I went down to the Bzorka Beartooth because I kept hearing how those guides down there got paid better. And so I went down there. There was a lot of elk. It was not my style of hunting, even though it was a wilderness hunt. It just wasn't my style. We hunted the park line and run up and down the park line trying to call elk out of the park. And that just wasn't my deal. And so, but I, you know, I signed on for the season. I did it for 1 year. And then after that, I went back to the Bob. And I stayed there through 99. And then I went down to the Washakie Wilderness in northwestern Wyoming. And I guided down there. And about 40 miles, we were up the East Fork of the Wind River, about 40 miles from the park. And across the hill, over the hill from the Woods River and Cody. A lot of your outdoor folks are going to recognize that from old Jim Zumbo talking about the Woods River and Cody,
Wyoming. Absolutely.
And we were over the hill from that, over in the East Fork of the Wind River. And I got it there from 2000. The last trip I went up there to go to camp to help them was in 22. And trying to show some of the guides. I told them for years, I said, y'all got to get some young fellas in here. I'm about played out. And in 22, I went up there and was trying to show some of the guys where to hunt, where not to hunt, and, you know, where, you know, how to play some of the basins and stuff, because the wind will get you if you get in certain spots. And trying to give them a heads up of what I had taken 20 years to learn. And give them a heads up on this is the way you hunt this area. And, you know, so.
And then you ended up in Mexico for a while.
I did. It was great. it was great because I was able to, well, there was a time that I would go to Montana and start 1st of June and do first of June till July. We had 40 head of horses to shoot. We had, you know, all kind of stuff to do. We make a couple of trips and run into the mountains to kind of prep up stuff for when we were going to go hunting. Then we would do 6 progressive fly fishing summer trips into the Sun River and into the Middle Fork of the Flathead. And then you'd have 2 weeks to go to the early season where you'd do 4 8-day hunts and on the west side, and then you would go into the general season where you'd do 2 or 3 8-day hunts, and that would generally, most of the time, I would leave Montana right at Thanksgiving, get home in time to go to Mexico and go guide Mexico December and January. And so from the 1st of June to the end of January, I was hunting somewhere. But from the 1st of June till Thanksgiving, I was out there living in the wilderness. And then it all changed because from December to January, now I'm on a ranch where I can get sleeping inside. And most of those places were pretty nice. And
most of the Mexico camps were pretty good. And they generally had a pretty good cook as well, too.
Oh, yeah. Had good cooks. you know, you're hunting out of your pickup, you got a high rack on your truck. It's all different style from, but it was nice to have the difference, you know. It was nice to do something. Go sit in a blind instead of walking up and down the mountains. Go sit in a blind, just sit on your butt and sit there and watch your feeder and tell them age, right, and grade exactly. The deer. And then know that when you going back in the evening, you had a cooler of beer in the back of your truck. And, you know, on the way back in from the stand, you generally about a 2-beer drive.
Well, I know that you spent some time down there with a good friend of mine, Bill Whitfield.
Bill and
I owned an outfitting business together in Texas for a while and all those kind of things. And I recall some story from y'all used to every once in a while run across a mountain lion down there. I remember some story about you on the back of a truck pickup with a lion that had kind of maybe the Lazarus lion that came back to life.
Okay. They killed 4 lions down there. That ranch was infested, and they were losing a lot of deer. And one of the guides had found a yearling horse that morning, and he came back in and told the landowner. The landowner waited until almost dark, and he went out with one of his guys, and he got up in the high rack and let his man drive. And he was shooting at .223. And they went out to where that horse was and spotlight. It was right when he almost needed spotlight a little bit. And that lion was on that horse, and he shot it because he wasn't going long. And he brought it back in and had it in the back of the truck. Well, his high rack fit on the front half of the bed. The back half of the bed was just open pickup bed.
Right.
And so the landowner was sitting up in the high rack, and I was the first one out the door. He's backing up to the skinning shed, and I went out to, you know, okay, I'm going to go see what they got. You know, right. They're back already. And I walked around to the back of the truck, and the landowner says, "Be careful. I'm not sure he's dead." Okay. How do you load a live lion? You know,
yes,
and how
right.
do you keep him in the back of the truck? So, I mean, you know, this goes through my head. I'm looking. That lion is underneath the high rack, and then he had 2 spare tires. And this lion is laid over those spare tires. He's got his head against the driver's side of the bed, and his back feet against the passenger side of the bed. And I walk up, he's up there. I just turn around, walk up there, and I'm thinking, how's the lion get? You wouldn't load a lion like that.
No.
How would he get there? And I walked around and inadvertently just naturally reached in to touch it and pet it. And it's about then that the landowner says, "Well, be careful, I'm not sure he's dead." And I'm like, "Well, how can that be?" And just as my hand touches it, I see it like that.
Oh,
it takes a breath, and I'm already committed. My hand touches
it's there.
It.
Yeah,
yeah. And the instant my hand touched that lion, it sat up in my face. And
Oh my goodness!
And I just, you know, I did that old moonwalk thing. I sucked back about 15 feet, and all the boys that were coming in behind me. They loaded up in a Suburban that was standing right there and locked the doors.
Pretty quickly. And locked the doors.
Oh, yeah. And I'm standing there looking at this thing, and it's sitting there snarling and growling, but you can tell that something ain't right.
Right.
It don't feel good. And there was a older cowboy, one of the hands on the ranch, one of the Mexican guys. And he was an older guy, and he walked out there with a lariat rope. And he immediately started trying to fish that rope onto that lion.
Right.
He was going to get a loop on it and tie it off to the skinning shed and let him drive out from under it.
Yes.
That was the plan. Well, these old boys loaded up in that Suburban, they having a fit. You know, get away, or you're going to get bit. And I'm over there now. I'm helping this old cowboy, you know. And landowner says, "Y'all just be still." And he reaches from where he's at with that rifle and shoots it. And that's the end of it. You know, so that's how it ended. That cat weighed just a little over 200 pounds. And we had its back straps a couple of nights later. And I will testify in front of St. Peter, that is the best wild game meat there is back straps out of mountain lion. You get somebody that knows how to fix that. Don't mess it up with bacon and jalapenos and make poppers or none of that stuff. You just take that back strap out of mountain lion and you put that and grill it and
I've had it, and I will not disagree with you. Yeah. But that was a big lion.
That was a big lion.
Huge.
When they get that big, their head starts, instead of being angular, it starts rounding out.
Right.
And you can see the likeness to an African, lion.
Like a leopard or a lion, either one.
Yeah. It, when their head starts getting, they're so big that their head starts kind of looking more round. you're looking at it. Really big cat, it's and then if for people who don't know, because at the time I didn't know, but I watched him weigh this cat, and then later I was reading and Googling. So how big? They always talk about a big leopard. Leopards don't get that big.
Very seldom do they reach 200 pounds. I shot a huge leopard in Namibia years ago, and it weighed 184 pounds. Mm-hmm. But it also didn't have anything in its belly. So it would have probably been a 200-pound cat had it eaten. But anytime you cross that 150 line, particularly on mountain lion or cougar,
right,
that's a big cat.
That's a monster. And like I said, this one had killed a yearling, yearling horse. And he'd come back to feed. We had mountain lions, of course, where I was at in the Bob Marshall.
Right.
And one of the best pieces of advice that I was given, one of the local boys that was also an outfitter, he said, don't start making rules about what you think a lion will and will not do, because they'll make a liar out of you. They'll make a liar out of you. Generally, a lion is going to want fresh meat. That's why there's death on a deer herd. That's why you see, like in the Bob, different places, you see a mule deer population suffering. And I say, well, there's a lion in every drainage. And, they're very territorial as far as big toms wiping out the younger cats.
Oh, yeah.
But at the same time, that's how come you wind up with so many of them in people's neighborhoods now. But they're hard on because they want fresh meat. They may kill something, but now here I am making it up, and he just told me not to. They'll kill something. They may come back to it once, but then after it starts turning just a little bit rancid, right, they'll want a fresh kill.
Exactly. So when the weather's warmer, they're going to kill more. The other thing that's happened in some of those areas in Colorado, particularly in parts of New Mexico, is the coyote population has greatly, greatly increased. And mm-hmm. what's happened there is that lion makes a kill, takes one meal of it, and leaves it. And guess what? The coyotes eat it up. Well, then, whereas maybe he killed in the cooler weather once every week or something like that, once every 4 or 5 days, now he's forced to kill a little bit more often, or is. So
right.
that's kind of compounded the situation. The lion thing is very interesting, because here in Texas, I know there's a lot of things going on right now with mountain lion in terms of, should it be a game animal? Should it be protected? Should it be this? But the lion here in Texas has basically been a non-animal for years. And so there were no regulations as to kills or bag limits or anything like that. And even in the face of that, the mountain lion population has increased many times over, many fold over compared to some of the other states where they have regulations.
I got a bad grade in a class at A&M. I went back to A&M when I was an adult.
Right.
And I took all their journalism classes. I was in my 40s. And I took all their journalism classes. And I took a parks and tourism class as a elective. And during that, we went to Big Bend. And so a bunch of us went out there, a bunch of students. I went out there, a bunch of students. We went to Big Bend. And part of it was they did a slideshow out there. And they had a ranger do a slideshow. And this young lady was I think, just out of college, and did a slideshow about lions. Okay. We get back to A&M, and I find out, okay, now we're supposed to write a paper about what was something that we noticed at Big Ben. And I wrote a paper, and I said, all right, we went to this slideshow presentation, and this young ranger put on his presentation and talked about loss of habitat, environmental missteps that happened in the 40s and 50s and on into the 60s that were detrimental to the environment. And I'm looking around. Now, this is back in the mid-90s when I'm there, and the people that's sitting around me are all retired people. They're all the age I am now or older. They're all our age, in between 65 and 75.
Right.
And I'm looking around, and she's talking directly to these people, and I felt like they were a little uncomfortable because she was hitting a little bit on them about, you know, they didn't take care of things right. The way they should have. She never said anything. I knew there are more mountain lions in North America at the time than there ever had been in any time previous.
Right.
But she kind of browbeat these people about, you know, not being environmentally minded enough.
Right.
And that was my takeaway on the deal. And that's what I wrote my paper on. And I got a bad grade.
I got
a bad grade.
What the prof wanted you to write?
Well, we had a little old teacher's assistant teaching that class from Massachusetts.
That kind of explains a whole lot right there just in itself, doesn't it?
Yeah. I think I had I think she was a little bit left-handed. And didn't agree.
Probably so, yeah.
Did not agree with my viewpoint on what I watched, you know.
Or what you saw.
I'm watching this. I know the information on the lions. She didn't say anything that wasn't correct, but could have delivered it a lot better.
I got tickled years ago when I worked for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. They first started doing some of the non-game thing, and we got a non-game biologist that was assigned to work on things like mountain lion and Mexican eagles or the caracaras and getting a handle on everything. And this person came out with a statement that there were 101 mountain lions in the state of Texas total. This goes back away, back into the late 70s and middle to late 70s. And at that time, we knew several ranches out in West Texas that had killed 100 lions that year.
Yeah.
And so those numbers weren't quite right. And then, too, that same person said there were 52 caracaras in all of Texas. And on any given day, you could drive the Mines Road out of Laredo or any direction from Laredo and see 50 to 100 caracaras. Of course, they too have increased their population to where I've seen them out in our country being out west of Houston away and just north of there a little bit. They're all pretty scattered all over the state of Texas right now.
Well, don't let anybody tell you they taste like chicken because they don't.
I've eaten a lot of different things in my lifetime, and of course, a lot of them were years and years ago when my father-in-law and I got on a kick and we shot everything we could and we prepared something from it, from everything. But back then we didn't have any caracaras, thankfully, so I didn't have to eat any of those.
No, I'm just messing with you. I couldn't imagine that. They're pretty, but they're just a little buzzard.
Yeah, they are. They're a raptor buzzard, I guess, if you will.
But that's I think my point being that is, you know, what we're trying to do with Texas Outdoor Writers Association is, again, talk about the North American wildlife model for conservation. And, you know, when you get a hold of something, it's all based on science. And when you get a hold of something and you present it, you should present it accurately and not do these programs and go, you know, oh, my God, you know, we're losing all the lions, when actually, there are more lions than there ever have been.
Exactly.
You know, it's you know, tell people the truth. Give people honest information. Tell them the truth. Show them you know, it's based on science. This is what works. This is, you know.
Absolutely. And you kind of jumped ahead of me just a little bit. Because I was just about to ask something about the fact that you've been very much involved with the TOWA, Texas Outdoor Writers Association, for the last several years now. Mm-hmm. As on the board of directors and no telling what else positions you've held either officially or kind of were forced to hold unofficially as well, too. We talked about this a little bit in the past, and you mentioned the North American model of conservation.
Right.
And how do you see spreading that word to
the general public? We got to give it to the kids. When the kids hear it, the parents are going to hear it. I quit fussing about it. This hasn't happened since 37, and when it should have.
Right.
All right. But we got to get the word out now, because this is the way we're going to have wildlife in the future. And if, you know, in an urban world, people need to know how conservation works. And this is the way it's worked since 1937. And it's a big point. We love to talk about guns. We love to talk about hunting. We love to talk about bullets. We love talking about fishing, what bait to use, all that. Know why those critters are there. Know why they're there. It's in that this is all science based. And one of the things I'll give to people who are not such big hunters and stuff, and they look at it and they can't quite figure it out, I say, you know, where critters need to be left alone, we leave them alone. This don't mean if there's five of them, you got to go hunt four of them.
No.
If there's places where animals need to be left alone, leave them alone.
Absolutely.
And it is simple animal husbandry that dictates how these how conservation works. I mean, it's just simple. I always said it's the birds and the bees. It's that simple. All right. So nowadays they screw that up. You don't even have the birds and the bees working the way they used to. You know, now we got that big controversy going on in this world. But in actuality, it's simple animal husbandry. If you look at a herd of cattle, you don't keep a bull till he's 10 years old and he's fighting off the young bulls and not allowing them to breed the cattle. And meanwhile, they can't breed the cattle. So next year, you've got a, you know, you don't have a very good calf herd. Same thing happens in wildlife.
Absolutely.
And so that's why, and you recognize spin words like trophy hunting. All right. Well, it just so happens them big ones are the older ones. Okay. So those are the guys you're at. Those are the ones you're after. And, you know, you get some of those terminologies and explain them away and go, this is, you know, this is the way it works. This is how it is. This is animal husbandry. And in order to maintain and promote a wildlife population, this is the way you do it. And you take out the older males in a herd, you know, and when you take out what you and I would call cull bucks, all right, you're taking out the lesser health, these are the ones in the herd that are not necessarily the strongest individuals of their species. You're getting them out of there. You're keeping the best ones in there. And so, I mean, that's just simple animal husbandry. And that's what conservation is all about. And that's the way it works in wildlife conservation. It's a scientific deal. And then you want to go one more deal, and we'll talk about predators and having to maintain control of predators, because every predator on the face of the earth gets a bloodlust. When they smell blood, they're going to kill as many as they can, whether it's coyotes, wolves, grizzly bears, anything. If they have an opportunity, they will kill for the fun of it. And it's not just the old and the weak.
No.
I had one of the Montana boys tell me one time, he said, you ever want to see a grizzly bear really have fun? Watch him get in a pen full of sheep where they can't get away.
I can imagine.
He said,
I'm not saying that, but I can imagine what happened.
He said, you talk about look like a cat playing with a mouse. He said, he'll kill every sheep in the pen and just have more fun throwing them in the air and throwing them around and killing them. And he said, And we've seen that now with wolf predation on elk herds, killing elk and leaving them lay. And just, it's predator, the nature of predator. That is, I think every predator on this earth has a bloodlust. And, you know, it's what old Stan Lin say in that ricochet thing. He said, you notice the predators all have their eyes in the front and the prey all has their eyes on the side. And, you know, you look where ours are.
Yep. A pretty definitive explanation there when you get right down to it. You're right. I get so tickled all the time. Tickle is not the right term. I get so aggravated because in the days where a lot of times it's, oh, they only take the sick and the infirm and all that kind of stuff. I tell people it's no different. You go to the grocery store and you're looking at meat and there's this piece of meat that's got crud growing all over it, or it's gray and there's this freshly cut piece of meat that shows a lot of red and all that. Which one are you going to pick? Are you going to pick the one that's looked like it's already bad, or are you going to pick the one that's spoiled, or are you going to pick the fresh one? And predators are the same way. There's some that are opportunists that will take whatever they can, but for the most part, if there is an opportunity to take the healthiest animal in the herd, that's what they're going to take.
That's
just the way of life, but unfortunately, too many people don't understand that. And maybe years ago when some of the early TV shows and all those things kind of started, maybe Walt Disney would have served the wildlife better if he'd have shown what really happens instead of what his producers thought should happen.
Right. Right. I'll tell you what, I'm going to plug somebody right quick.
Please do.
Sue Tidwell wrote a book, Cries from the Savannah. And it is a wonderful book because it's written from the perspective of a lady observer going to Africa with questions in her mind about why do you hunt all these different critters? Now, she grew up in a hunting family. Right. She grew up eating deer. She told me she had four brothers and a daddy. And I said, you mean you never got an opportunity to go hunt? And she said, oh, no, me and Mom were just so happy when they left. And, her current, she's married to a gentleman. They live in Idaho. They hunt elk, and she knows all about camp. They can go up camp and do all that. And so she was used to all this, but was foreign to, why would you do this in Africa? Why would you go hunt all these different things? And she wrote a book, Cries of the Savannah, and it is a great book. It's a wonderful book. And her name is Sue Tidwell. If you can find that book, because it explains everything about as well as I've ever heard it explained. And it's coming from a hunter's wife, an observer.
Right.
And, you know, it's all about camp. It's all about the 24 people that took care of the four people in camp. Talks about those people and gives you a description of them. And, it's great. It's a great book. It really explains very well a whole lot about wildlife conservation and from a perspective, from a lady's perspective and from an observer's perspective, and puts a lot of things into, explains it very well for somebody who would just, be curious, who cares enough to be curious. Right.
You just made a huge statement right there.
Yeah.
I've not had the opportunity to read the entire book. I've read a few excerpts from it, and I'll see if you even suggested I get in touch with her some time ago, and unfortunately my schedule was really kind of screwed up for a while. It still continues to be that way, but I definitely want to have her on the podcast, and from the excerpts that I've read of her book, I can't wait to get her on. I really need to get her on here, and I think a lot of folks will have a better appreciation for a lot of different things if they listen to her.
I enjoyed her book so much. Now I'll tell you a little personal note on that. We went to the Poma Conference,
right,
and she won the Pinnacle Award with that book. All right. My little Lost Rider book won Outstanding Achievement. Okay. So that's like first and second. And I'm sitting there thinking, just personally, I'm like, all right, I got to look at this book. Beat me,
yeah, you know? Exactly.
And, you know, yeah, that's maybe, I don't want to be arrogant about it. But, yeah, no, I was very, I want to see it. And then when I picked it up and started reading it, I went, oh, hell yeah, that's a lot better than mine. God damn, you know, this is so much better than mine. I can't even, you know, yeah, I just got my ass kicked.
But, you know, if that happens with the right person, it doesn't hurt nearly
much. No, it's great. I plug them every chance I get. I'll plug her every chance I get. It's a great book. And, I mean, it's a great book, and it's all about exactly who we are.
Absolutely. Herman, we're going to shut this down because I've got to go mend fences on my little place. The neighbor's cattle are getting in on some of my wildlife stuff that I've got going on. But tell me, or tell our listeners, what's the best way to get in touch with you? And I want you to again mention the radio show, because you cover such a wide array of topics that are wildlife and outdoor oriented. They're not just hook and bullet stuff. We get to talk about that, but you get into some of the real issues and you get an opportunity to talk to the people who really have influences on some of the things that happen these days. So how does somebody get in touch with you, and what's the best way to do so? And also need to mention too that you've written several books now, and fabulous reading at people, I'm telling you. I'd put his books up against anybody's and his writing style against anybody's. And I'm a little biased, but it's the way I look at it. So tell us how to get copies of your books and how to get in touch with you.
Best thing is HWB at lost writer rider.com. That's kind of become my little nickname, some moniker, or whatever you call it, the Lost Rider. There's three Lost Rider books. The Lost Rider from Yopon Creek, Christmas Tales from the Lost Rider, and The Lost Rider and Friends. And that was just something I came up with one time because, the first thing was I lost the horses up in the Sun River one time. It took me 2 days to find them back. And I was tracking them through country I'd never been in, and I was lost. The other way of looking at that is, in some fashion, we're all lost riders trying to make it through the world. And I play on that quite a bit.
True. Yes, sir.
But that is the best way is HWB at thelostrider.com. Phone number 979-732-4707. Best thing to do is text that number because I don't always answer it.
You and me both. I don't answer my phone very often, but I do respond to texts. So.
Yeah. The radio program, News from the Camp House. Like I said, we will talk about anything and everything. Any conversation comes up around camp, and if it ends with a question, we'll try to find the answers. And I'll talk to anybody I have to do. I've done this from here to Wyoming to Montana, talking to whoever it takes to find the answers for what we're looking for. What else you want to know?
Give me the how to get in touch with you. Both
okay. HWB, that's initials, HWB, at TheLostRider.com, TheLostRider.com, 979-732-4707.
Herman, thank you so much for joining us around the campfire. I cannot wait to get back with you. We'll do so here in maybe a couple of 3 months at the very latest. Thank everybody for joining us this morning, this afternoon, or whenever it is you have an opportunity to listen to the podcast. And we'll be right back here with you next week.
DSC Campfires with Larry Wysoon has also been brought to you by Double Nickel Taxidermy, preserving your outdoor memories. Burham Brothers Game Calls, the callingest call made. Texas Wildlife Association, working for tomorrow's wildlife today. And the Crown Bar of LaGrange and Round Top, Texas.